Hi, this is Perry, and you're listening to episode 45 of Chemist Corner. Hello, and welcome to Chemist Corner. I'm your host, Perry Romanowski. Chemist Corner is a show about formulating cosmetic products. I'm a cosmetic chemist, and I share formulating tips, industry news, I discuss cosmetic science, and we usually interview some of the top cosmetic experts. On today's show, we are going to focus on cosmetic preservatives. This is a hot topic right now, especially since the number of allowed preservatives seem to be ever decreasing. We've got one of the industry's foremost experts on the subject, Dean Godfrey, to talk about cosmetic preservation. But first, I thought I'd cover a question about preservation that new formulators might be wondering. Here's a question sent to us about formulating with preservatives. This person asked, why do the raw material suppliers recommend the combination of preservatives versus using them alone? For example, why do the manufacturers recommend a combination of sodium benzoate and potassium sorbate rather than using them individually? With all the bad press about chemicals used to preserve cosmetics, you might be wondering why companies don't just stop using preservatives altogether. Well, the reason is that cosmetics that contain preservatives are more safe than ones that don't contain preservatives. This is because disease-causing microorganisms can multiply at exponential rates in cosmetics if there's no chemical in there to stop them. And if the consumer is putting a dollop of micro-laden skin lotion on their body, they are bound to contract some kind of disease. It is just not smart to use unpreserved cosmetics, in my opinion. Now, the other reason you might include preservatives is that when microbes grow in your cosmetic product, they can produce foul-smelling odors and strange colors. Consumers just aesthetically do not want to use bacterial-contaminated products. It's a bit like the same reason people don't want to eat moldy bread. So now we got to think about what do preservatives do. Cosmetic formulas have all the key factors needed for microbial growth, including water, nutrients, and energy. At a suitable pH and temperature, it will be likely that a microbial cocktail party will start up. Preservatives stop the growth by killing cells and spores. Usually this is done by disrupting cell membranes, or they work by making the system hostile to growth. So that brings us to the question that started it all. Why use multiple cosmetic preservatives? Basically, it's because most single preservatives do not kill a big enough range of microorganisms. As a cosmetic formulator, you need to ensure that your preservative system will kill any bacteria, mold, or fungi that the formula might encounter. Now, since you don't know what will be encountered, you have to plan for every possibility, or at least as many possibilities as you can. There are some preservatives that are able to kill a wide range of microbes. These are like alcohol, parabens, formaldehyde donors. Now that is why these ingredients are so popular with formulators. Other ingredients like sodium benzoate or potassium sorbate are only effective against certain types of microbes. They are more effective against yeast and molds, but they have a much less activity against bacteria. So one way to compensate for the ineffectiveness of one component is to include another compound that has the ability to kill other organisms. So by combining your preservatives, you increase the spectrum of microbes that your formula can withstand. And this is why manufacturers suggest that you do use multiple preservatives in a single formulation. Of course, if you use parabens and formaldehyde donors, you could really become more confident in the effectiveness of your preservative systems. These ingredients typically will kill a broad range of microorganisms and at pretty low levels, so they really are a good choice. However, for marketing reasons, a lot of times people are going to want to avoid these compounds, so it really does make your formulation job a bit harder. But suffice it to say, the reason the main reason that you should use multiple preservatives, especially if you're avoiding the parabens and the formaldehyde donors of the world, is because using multiple preservatives will kill a broader range of bacteria, molds, and other microorganisms. Dean Godfrey is the owner of Independent Preservation Advice Limited. He has been involved with the preservation of cosmetics since 1981 and has worked for such companies as Azelis, MSG Micropure, Nipa Laboratories, and more. He is also heavily involved in the Society of Cosmetic Scientists and is a regular contributor to the website Personal Care Truth. Welcome to the program, Dean.
Hi, Perry. Thank you.
Well, Dean, this is actually the second time you've been on the program. The first time was a few years back. You were one of our early guests. And so you're actually the only, the second two-time guest that we've had.
I'm honored.
There we go. Well, I saw on the interwebs that you have started a new consultancy about preservatives. So I wanted to talk about that and see what you had to say about the world of cosmetic preservatives. So before we get into that, though, let's talk about how'd you get to specialize in preservatives? How'd you start in the cosmetic industry and then get turned to preservatives?
That's by accident is the honest answer. I started off working in a chemistry lab as a technician working up chemical processes, and I was offered a chance to work in a new department that was focusing on Bronopol. This was for the Boots company many years ago. And I worked on industrial applications and cosmetic applications, formulating Bronopol. And I realized that I enjoyed the cosmetics industry much more than I enjoyed wood, metalworking, and paper industries. And I got a job at Nipa Laboratories in 1992, where I was able to focus on the personal care industry. And I've been involved with the personal care side of preservation ever since.
I've heard that about the personal care industry just from other people who have worked in other industries. They said that the personal care industry is filled with really nice people, whereas some other industry aren't.
I wouldn't go so much to say about the industry, but certainly the personal care industry is full of great people, and it has been a pleasure working in that industry so far, and I hope to continue to do so.
Now, over the years, you must have worked on a bunch of different projects. What kind of projects did you work on as far as preserving cosmetics go and that sort of thing?
A lot of my career has been spent developing preservative blends. When I started in the industry, I will say when I started in the industry proper with Nipa Laboratories, there weren't too many blends around. Phenonip was by far the biggest blend, and a few others from people like ISP. And so I worked on blending not just parabens, but other combinations. And also a lot of my roles over the years have been just talking to customers and trying to find solutions to problems, preservation related, of course. But I've been involved with everything from sales, marketing, and new product development.
That has been one of the biggest challenges for formulators, right? Getting proper preservation for their products. In fact, a couple years ago, I heard this company who makes a sunscreen for kids had their products recalled because of bacterial contamination. It seems like there has been a lot more of these kinds of recalls because of bad preservations. Why do you think cosmetics have become less preserved lately?
Well, cosmetic preservation has always been a challenge, but increasingly so due to more recent events with media attacks on parabens, etc., and not only parabens. That's part of the problem, because people are moving away from parabens and more proven preservatives and pretty much experimenting to a certain extent. That might be too strong a word, arguably. But there are a lot of new preservatives that aren't so well proven as the old traditional favorites. I use the term loosely, favorites.
Why do you think some of the traditional preservatives that have worked so well over the years, like parabens and formaldehyde donors, why have they gotten such a bad name over the last few years?
Well, I could talk for at least an hour on parabens alone, but I'll be brief on that. Basically, a couple of studies, one in 1998 and the other one in 2004, sowed the seeds for the current perception of parabens. The first study identified some estrogenic activity, but that activity was extremely weak. But it got blown up out of all proportion. And then a researcher called Philippa Darborough at Reading University claimed to have discovered or detected intact parabens in human breast cancer tissue. I've written several articles analyzing the paper, and really it doesn't stand up to close scrutiny. Yet the pressure groups, the environmental working group, are one of the worst for this, have taken this and run with it and distorted the facts, really. And everyone, or most people, take both of those studies well out of context. And that's the problem. It's context. It's the public misunderstanding of science or mistrust of science. And they will believe the scare stories over and above the rational scientific explanations, unfortunately.
Is there any basis for concern, though?
I would say no, but it's as well to keep an eye on concerns, because if someone has a concern, if there is a reason for the concern, it should be addressed. The problem with parabens is, or problem for parabens, should I say, is that the concerns have been addressed. More studies have been carried out in more recent years, and the European Union's Independent Scientific Advisory Body, the SCCS, have ruled several times as each concern has been expressed. They've looked again at newer evidence or requested further testing, and they have determined that they are safe for use in cosmetics. Okay, propyl and butyl paraben have had their maximum permitted concentrations reduced, but they weren't used above those concentrations anyway, so there's no material difference. So people are basically saying they don't trust the independent scientists employed by the European Union when they say parabens are not safe.
This is the one question that you can never get an answer from these I call them fear-mongering groups.
I do too.
They suggest that we should follow the precautionary principle, which says that if there's any hint of a problem, it's banned until you can prove that it's safe. But you ask them the question, well, what proves that something is safe? There's never an answer to that. They can only ban stuff. They never say, well, now we're convinced that it's safe.
Yes, I do take issue with the precautionary principle. It all sounds well and good, but it has to be based on reasonable evidence. If you took the precautionary principle to its ultimate conclusion, you would never drink water, because if you drink too much water, it can kill you. So there has to be some context to using the precautionary principle. It's almost an excuse not to make a proper informed decision.
Right. Now, I've seen some of these big companies have almost capitulated to these fear-mongering groups and consumer backlash, I guess. J&J just recently reformulated their baby shampoo, for example, and lots of people contact me looking for alternatives to parabens. Do you think companies should be kowtowing to these kinds of fears?
It's easy for me to sit here and say, no, I don't think they should. But of course, if these pressure groups generate enough publicity, adverse publicity, then they can actually damage the businesses of these companies. I would love to see companies such as J&J and Avon standing firm, but I do understand that they have to make a commercial decision. However, I wonder if there is any real effect on sales of paraben-based products, because I find that the majority of people still don't know about parabens.
That has been my experience too. When I've given talks in front of people, I frequently will ask people if they know about the controversy with parabens, and and this is a group of formulators who, you know, half of them haven't even heard the concerns. So I wonder how much do consumers really know about these concerns about parabens or any of the preservatives?
Very little, I'm sure. There is a small core of, maybe you could describe them as activists. Some would call them chemophobes, but not me, of course, who will seize on any negative publicity for any chemical substance. And I mean synthetic chemical substance.
Right.
Because that is another favorite soapbox topic of mine, chemical free.
Right. Well, it's such a ridiculous claim to call say chemical free, but you see it's everywhere.
Yes, of course. Yes. It's as ridiculous as assuming that if it's natural, it must be safe. And anyone who really thinks deeply enough about that knows that that can't possibly be true. And the converse is not true either, that synthetic is automatically dangerous.
Right, and I think what happens is people don't think very deep about it. It's just sort of a gut reaction.
I hope no people listening.
Well, as far as people listening, we mostly have formulators here. Are there preservative options that they can use if their company is telling them you can't use parabens and you can't use formaldehyde donors? What would formulators use?
Well, there are plenty of other options, and there always have been. And after the parabens story broke, and people were talking as though that any other preservatives were new options, and there've been options for 30 or 40 years. What they can use is dependent upon what they want from a preservative system and what claims they want to make. For their product, if indeed they want to make any specific preservative-related claims at all. And there is a difference between the US and the European Union, of course, because in the EU, the preservatives are highly prescriptive. Annex 5 of the Cosmetic Regulation tells you which preservatives you can use. There are a lot of people finding ways around that, shall we say. But it's different in the States because you can use pretty much anything that has any antimicrobial activity without claiming or without falling foul of any legal issues. So there are plenty of options of the sort of the traditional preservatives. The range is becoming more limited because of the common ones permitted in the EU, you're reduced to phenoxyethanol, benzyl alcohol, and organic acids almost. There are several other, there are probably about 30 other compounds listed, but they are sometimes very restricted in their application areas for one reason or another, or simply not popular for various reasons. Orthophenol is on Annex 5. I've never come across anyone using that in cosmetics, but it is permitted. There are other preservatives that I would put in quotation marks because they're not on the EU list. The most frequently used those is caprylyl glycol, which is no problem in the States, but in the EU it's not a permitted preservative. So you have to find an alternative primary function for it. And claim that the antimicrobial activity is secondary.
Okay, so if you're going to put caprylyl glycol in there, you have to have some other reason why it's in there, not as a preservative.
Yeah, I mean, caprylyl glycol has been used as an emollient for many years. So if you have a product that requires an emollient, then there is no issue with using caprylyl glycol. However, if you try and put it in a product that you wouldn't put an emollient in, then it's more difficult to justify.
Right, right. It seems like every day there's more bad news about whatever traditional preservatives out there. I know methyl isothiazolinone is getting some bad news in the EU. Do you see any like good news with preservatives, or are there any new ones being introduced that could solve these problems?
Well, the short answer to that is no. The problem, and this is peculiar to the European Union, because we've kind of, I'll say we, the legislators have cut off our nose to spite our face, in a sense, because with the banning of all animal testing for cosmetics ingredients, then you can't develop a new preservative for use in the EU. So that's very restrictive now. I'm not saying whether from an animal testing point of view, obviously that's great, but from a practical point of view for cosmetic scientists, that's a huge problem.
That does seem to be the big problem with getting rid of all animal testing, is that I don't see how you can make a new raw material.
No, there appears to be no way around that at the moment, until people start accepting in vitro testing alternatives. That, of course, would permit the use of other compounds. But there are, I've not looked into animal testing or the requirements too deeply, but I think there are still quite a few tests that for which there are no in vitro alternatives, which are essential to proving the safety of new substances. So it is a bit of a problem.
Yeah, it's a challenge for raw material suppliers. I know one of the tricks of getting around it has been that they still allow animal testing for pharmaceutical ingredients. And if you introduce something as a pharmaceutical ingredient, you can use that data for cosmetic ingredients. But
yes, but then you have a lot of other, a lot of the manufacturers, cosmetics manufacturers, who have rules based on the British Union for of vivisection, to think about that, who state that you can set your own cutoff date for animal testing, but the supplier must not be supplying more than 50% of their production for use in cosmetics, which is a weird one, because that throws up the interesting situation where maybe one manufacturer only sells 10% of their material into cosmetics, so their material is BUAV approved, so lots of people go and start buying their material, and the percentage shoots up to over 50%, so it's no longer BUAV approved. That makes sense, because it doesn't to me.
Right, that is very strange. Well, thanks so much for coming on. Now, you've started this new consultancy business. Why don't you tell everybody a little about what you're doing and what kind of clients you're looking for?
Okay, I'm looking for as many clients as possible. And what I would like to do is just be an independent resource for the cosmetics industry to give advice on preservation, either on individual situations, this is my formulation, what do you recommend, sort of thing, and or general advice on a preservation strategy. I find a lot of companies don't really have a strategy and tend to use a lot of different preservation systems, both blends and individual components, without a lot of thought. So they end up with 20 or 30 or even 40 different preservative products, which is a lot of inventory, and I can give advice on how to rationalize that down. And I also offer a training presentation, which I've been giving for over 20 years, sort of an entry level into preservatives and preservation. And I also offer a presentation called Parabens in Perspective, which there might not be too much call for these days. So.
Well, it's an excellent article series that you have there.
Yes, there are links to the Parabens articles that I wrote for the Personal Care Truth website, on my website, www.ipaltd.co.uk.
And if people wanted to get in contact with you, should they do it right through that website then?
Yes, or they can contact me directly by email. That's Dean, spelled D-E-N-E, at ipaltd.co.uk. It's important to spell my name correctly, of course.
Well, I'll be sure to put that in the show notes so they can get that directly. Well, thanks so much, Dean, for coming on the show. It's been great having you.
Yeah, I look forward to the third time.
All right, that brings us to the end of another show for Chemist's Corner. Thanks so much for listening. I'm your host, Perry Romanowski. Remember, you can participate in a discussion on cosmetic science by going to our forum, chemistcorner.com/cosmeticsciencetalk. We have over 2,000 cosmetic chemists from around the world who have start discussions, talk about different things that are of interest to cosmetic formulators. Also, we are preparing a preservation webinar that'll be coming up in the next months. In case you're listening to this in the future, that would be sometime around the end of June of 2015. We still should have it archived, so even if you are listening to this far in the future, you should be able to get that preservation webinar. You can also follow us on Facebook. We have a Facebook page, and also on Twitter. We are active on Twitter. The following is Chemist Corner. Also, if you have an idea of posting an iTunes review, that would be nice. That helps boost the profile of the show and get other people to listen. Thanks so much for listening. I'm your host, Perry Romanowski. Now, go make a difference.